After getting a thorough introduction to the step and a half dairy farm, I was on the milk run early one morning, and on Old Fourth Avenue, which is considerably of less stature than it is now, since the total population of all Anchorage was about 2,500, I should stop at a crossing and locate none other than James Cook, the lad with whom I had made an acquaintance in Juneau. And he said that he had just arrived in Anchorage and was trying to line up some manner to go northbound. And I told him that I had the job, and jobs were very tough to find, and that I was fortunate to have the job driving the dairy truck. He said, "How much money do you have?" I looked, and I think I had $15 total cash funds available. So he said, "Look, why don't we go down to the railroad depot and see how far that will get the both of us. We'll go northbound." So I considered the thing for a moment and said, that might be a good idea. So we took the $15 and discovered that it might buy us two tickets to a place known as Talkeetna. Talkeetna, they said, was a small mining village about 145 miles north of Anchorage via the railroad route. I turned the milk truck in, gathered up my clothes from Step and a Half Dairy Farm, boarded the Alaska train with James Cook, and we arrived in Talkeetna. And certainly enough, Talkeetna was a sight to behold. At this point, the miners were coming in from the mines, and there was great activity in the Cache Creek gold mines and the Fairview gold mines. The miners' plan would be to come in from the mines, re-outfit, and most of them would go back out into the hinterland and the brush trapping for the winter. Some of them that made it hit it lucky during the summer would hopefully go back to the old country of Finland or Ireland or Germany or Norway on the long trip, a long-awaited, long-expected planned trip to the old country. There was a considerable amount of native villagers, considerable number of native villagers in Talkeetna. And they lived along the old Talkeetna River as it intercepts the Susitna. The meaning of the word Talkeetna is the meeting of the three rivers, the Talkeetna, the Susitna, and the Togesitna, Chulitna rivers, all run together in the near proximity of Talkeetna. So in the old Aleut language, the word itself means the meaning of the three rivers. This native settlement was complete with dog teams and smoked moose meat and salmon drying in the sun, and the smoke of the wood fires wafting across the town, mingled with the booze fumes of those making homebrew, and the raucousness of the several booze joints in town made for a very colorful village. And the continual howling of the many dogs, and in the case of a low overcast and a snowstorm, was an ideal setting. And exactly what I had featured Alaska to be all about. We had looked around the town of Talkeetna, firstly for a place to stay. An old timer had a homestead a mile from town, and he said, "Boys," he says, "you're welcome to use my homestead cabin to use as your headquarters till you either get a job at the mines when the breakup comes around, or at least while you chop wood and do odd jobs around town during the winter." So the old man's name was Perkins, fine old fellow. And so we moved lock, stock, and barrel into the Perkins homestead. Now, the second morning, we looked out of the cabin into the face of a raging blizzard. And 4 or 5 feet of snow fell before a clearing finally arrived. In the meanwhile, we had circulated around this active village of Talkeetna to see if there was a possible chance that we might find some type of employment. Sure enough, they were short of wood. Now, the way you cut wood was by hand. You sharpened your axe and sharpened the saw and went into the woods and cut wood the hard way. It's a very slow process, but we cut about 30 cords of wood, all told, in the next 3 months. And as the days grew shorter, it was more of a project to cut the tree down and to buck up the tree into stove-sized wood. About a week after our arrival in Talkeetna, an early one frosty morning in the clear-off, I heard a very unusual noise outside this old log cabin. Also, the temperature dropped about 20 below zero, and there was a 5-foot cover of snow on the ground. The crunching of the snow brought to my attention that we had a visitor. So I looked out of the door. Sure enough, there was a visitor there. Tremendous bull moose looked into the cabin as I looked out, and all I could visualize was moose chops. So I had no inclination that the season wasn't open for moose. However, I stealthily slipped back into the cabin, got my very faithful 22 Special Savage rifle, and looked the moose once more eye to eye, and one shot later we had plenty of moose chops. We, as a matter of fact, I related the good luck of the moose hunt to an old gal, a fine old lady that run one of the stores in Talkeetna. And she said, "Son, I'll trade you a bag of flour and a sack of sugar for a hind quarter of that moose." She said, "We've not had moose meat all winter." And out of the goodness of her heart, she had made the offer, full knowing that the moose season was closed. So I said, "It's a deal." So I sledded a quarter of moose meat. Deal was made. Also, there was a commissioner in the town of Talkeetna, and a very broad-minded commissioner he was also. He was aware of two lads cutting wood and trying to rough it out in the snowbanks of Talkeetna. And I asked him, I said, "When is the moose season open and when is it closed?" He said, "Well, the moose season's been closed for 2 months." "Why?" "Well," I said, "I just shot a moose." And he looked a little startled and he says, "Well, what are you going to do with the moose? Well, I said, we plan to eat the moose. And I said, I also traded off some of it for some groceries. And he said nothing further, and so I brought him a big moose chop later in the day. And apparently we were still not in trouble legally. So the wood cutting continued, and the moose chops sizzled in the iron skillet, and the storms raged, and the cords of wood stacked up, and we sold as much as we could cut. And then the great month of March arrived, and our cook said, "Say, I think I'll go back and join the merchant marine. It's just too rough a life." It wasn't quite what I had in mind, so he departed on the old Alaska Railroad southbound, and it was the last I ever heard of James Cook. But at any rate, long about that time, there was a disastrous fire in Talkeetna, and one of the old timers had lost his complete belongings and all of his personal gear and all his mining gear that he had in the cabin. So I invited him over to stay in what we call the stump ranch. This was the cabin that Cook and I were staying at. And we discussed the proposition of beaver trapping. And the old timer said that properly done, beaver trapping could be lucrative financially. So he explained in detail how you trap the beaver, how you skin the beaver, and we talked long into the night on the techniques of beaver trapping and how much the fur would be worth and all the details of trapping. So with all this knowledge, I bought several beaver traps and proceeded to go trapping. The second day I looked at the traps, I had a beaver, and the beaver was a large one. And so I attempted to skin the fur out rough, as explained by the old timer. My knife was dull, and actually there's two schools of thought. One is to skin the beaver clean, that's to peel him out like an onion, and the other is to skin him rough and then clean the rough off. Well, it took about 3 days to get the rough off, so I resolved that any beaver caught thereafter would be skinned clean, and this turned out to be the proper way to approach the beaver skinning problem. I caught a limit of beaver, for which I sold for a prime figure of about $20 each. And then it was a great activity again took place in Talkeetna, and all the miners were getting their supplies together, ready to go mining for the summer. And all available manpower was on deck to go to the hills to work in the Cache Creek in the Fairview placer gold mining area. And I was offered a job by an old timer from Nome who had settled in Talkeetna area and had found a rich placer deposit, which he and the wife worked by hand with the help of one or two young lads hired for the summer season. The agreement was to work 10 hours a day, every day, all week, all summer, at the rate of $5 a day. The standard procedure for the miners of the Talkeetna area was to get a start on the mining season, which was usually the middle of June. by going with freight loads into the mining area, which was 50 to 75 miles northwest of Talkeetna, with the use of horses, dog teams, and crawler caterpillars. In this manner, the freight, the needed freight for the mine operation, was taken into the area, and also the supplies and the hired hands for the season were moved into the location of the Cache Creek in the Fairview Mining District. This was quite a freighting project in view of the winter snow. Freighting usually started in the months of April and continued at least a month into the area. Over the deep depth of heavy winter snowfall, sometimes snow depth and deep drifts reached a thickness of 20, 30 feet, and it was a major operation to remove the snow with a bulldozer or to go over the top of the snow with the help of wide pad tracks, which was the order of the day in the freighting to the mines. In other words, there's a standard caterpillar track, and then there's the snow track, which is considerably wider and gives the machine a lighter footprint due to the greater area that the weight of the vehicle rests upon the snow. Anyway, the first season, 1939, beginning from May 1, was a location on Cottonwood Creek in the Cache Creek area, working for an old miner, as mentioned, one of the old Gold Rush miners from the Nome area, had found a very rich pay streak in the upper Cache Creek country, 55 miles northwest of Talkeetna. And the old miner with his wife and two or three hired hands would work by hand the high-grade placer deposit. Now this gold is a shock to behold. Is extremely bright gold, nearly absolutely pure, and it was in very coarse nuggets. Often the bedrock where the gold was recovered from would be blue clay, which was a tremendous contrast with the golden glitter of the gold itself. There's other types of bedrock too, but the greatest contrast was when the blue clay bedrock would be in the area of the gold cleanup and the gold resting on the blue clay was a very striking sight. Also, might add that a surprisingly small amount of gold added up to an ounce, about a teaspoonful of the finer gold in the match head class for size would level a teaspoonful and weigh 1 ounce. And this mine, as the other mines in the area, worked 10-hour shift every day, 7 days a week. And the rate of pay was 50 cents an hour. Of course, in 1939, the dollar was worth considerably more than it is now. Needless to say, the work was rugged, And there were four of us worked at the mine. One of the lads had an accident and badly wrenched his back in the first part of the month of July. And he returned back to Anchorage for hospitalization. This left Joy Bertel and one other lad and myself as placer hands at the Jenkins mine. This was in the style of a placer mine. There was a large ditch cut around the side of the mountain, which Mr. Jenkins had painstakingly cut by hand over a distance of 5 miles, and this was to gather water. In early springtime, in the mining area of the Cache Creek Hills, located about 55 miles west of Talkeetna, the snow stands in tremendous drifts, 50 feet deep in places, and the breakup begins in April, continues through May. It is the latter part of May or early June before placer mining operations can begin. There's a considerable amount of work that has to be done prior to the actual mining of the gold operation. The ditches carrying the water to the mine have to be opened by hand. That is, the heavy snowfall piles heavily upon the water ditches used to carry the water to the hydraulic mine site. The water, after the snow is removed from the ditches and then the ditch units, is then piped into a huge 4-foot pipe. That is, the pipe gathers water from the drainage ditch, which is tapped into a stream in the distance, and the water is compressed on its way through the 4-foot steel casing, and the casing graduates down finally into 6-inch diameter sections and develops a considerable amount of pressure in the process of being reduced from 4 feet to approximately 6 inches. And then furthermore, the hydraulic nozzles of the unit called a giant is further reduction down to about a 4-inch stream. So there's tremendous pressure that will result from this water dropping 500 feet vertically and being reduced from 4 feet to 4 inches in a diameter through a nozzle. And it is with this system that the earth and the smaller rocks are washed away. The overburden of the mine is washed away, and the concentrated pay dirt, that is the concentration of gold, is and heavy iron particles and the heavier rock material is left near bedrock. This is in turn washed with the hydraulic pressure towards big flume boxes. The boxes contain riffles which stop the gold as it flows over. the riffles and through the boxes. The overburden are large rocks in the earth, and lighter rock material go on through the boxes. The gold being heavy is stopped in the bottom of the placer. Riffles in the bottom of the box, and it is retained in this manner until the area is completely mined out, that is, washed completely through the boxes with the hydraulic pressure, and then the gold cleanup is then in progress. So it's usually about the middle of June before it's possible, due to the snow conditions, to proceed with the actual cleaning up of the gold. And there's a considerable amount of hard labor involved in moving the pieces of machinery that constitute the hydraulic mining operation. Mr. Jenkins had an old Caterpillar tractor which aided considerably in pulling the heavier pieces of pipe into position. Each new location of each pit, which was about 300 foot square, involved moving a complete setup of the hydraulic giants to wash the gravel into the sluice boxes, and then also another hydraulic unit to blast the heavy rocks and overburden material from the tail end of the box, which was located about 40 or 60 feet further downstream. And we had a total of seven cleanups, that is, during the process of the summer from mid-June until the last day of August. We cleaned up the sluice boxes, that is, recovered the gold from seven different pit locations. Each pit I mentioned is about 300 foot square. And this is almost a 95% a hand operation. That is, the with the exception of the assistance of the heavy Caterpillar to move the bigger sections of pipe, and also the main front section of the sluice boxes. We, I might say, had a very interested visitor. He was a large French-Canadian type, giant of a man, about 6 foot six. His name was Clark, and he figured prominently shortly thereafter in the tragedy that overtook the Jenkins mine. I mentioned that my friend Ira Deese had also worked at the mine through July and had injured his back and had gone to Anchorage for medical assistance. And shortly thereafter, I got a letter from him, and he said he was improving, and he would like very much to establish some cabins midway between the Cache Creek area and Talkeetna in the good fur country of the Coral River. So our arrangement was that the last day of August 1939, I was to work the full shift at the mine, and then stop the season at the 30th day of August, and catch the old freighter, a cat train, back into the village of Talkeetna. Air miles, I say, distance is about 55 miles, ground miles about 70 miles. So rather than walk the 70 miles, I was naturally interested in in catching the freighter, since I had a considerable load of personal clothing and other gear. So the season, as I say, was quite lucrative for the mine. Gold recovery was beyond expectations, and Mr. Jenkins and Mrs. Jenkins and Joy Battelle, the other hired hand, implored that I stay at least 2 more weeks into September to take out at least 1 or 2 more gold cleanups. But my prior arrangements had been made with my friend Dees, and so I continued with the plan to discontinue work at the mine and to catch this once a month cat train back to the village of Talkeetna. So after a 10-hour shift on the 30th of August, I shouldered my pack board with about 70 pounds of personal gear, and in a tremendous thunderstorm, covered the distance of about 10 miles to the pickup location. Photography introduction. I think I should offer as a background a fast rundown on early life in Wyoming. We were located on a ranch in the central section of Wyoming, near the Red Desert. This was the area formerly occupied by a number of warring Indian tribes, the Shoshones, the Crows, the Arapahoes, and occasional other Indian tribes would come into the very rich game country of central Wyoming and on war parties or on hunting trips. And as a result, to this day, farmers plowing in fields of the old battleground area turn up spearheads and various implements of the Indian warrior days of long ago. And this was also a route through South Pass, which was to the old Oregon Trail. In the sandstone, I recall, you could still see the deep ruts worn in the sandstone, which was the route of the trail to the west coast, called the Old Oregon Trail. Now this country of Wyoming was a tremendous buffalo and elk and bighorn sheep country, and and this accounted for all the action of the early day Indian tribes in the area. At one time in the Big Wind River country, there were thousands upon thousands of buffaloes in the lush valleys. And the main feed of the area was a small grass called bunch grass. And to this day, the cattle fatten and the sheep thrive, and all the herbivorous animals eat this very nutrient type range wild grass, and they all become fat as butterballs. At any rate, at the age of about 6 years old, I was located near the Wind River on an old ranch, and I lived with my parents and one sister, and each day through the school season we rode 5.5 miles to an old country school. Actually, the winters in Wyoming are quite severe, with a lot of wind and blowing snow long towards spring. The Chinook winds move in on the tail of the storms, and it makes driving and moving around on the surface quite hazardous. Our mode of travel was via horseback, and we commuted from our old ranch to the school building. And on one January day, I recall, as usual, we started out for school, and we had to get a 2-hour start in order to make it there by the time the bell rang, in order to cover the 5 miles. It was snowing at the time, and as we progressed en route to the school building, the storm worsened and the wind rose to gale force, and our strategy was to, when we became, I usually became colder than my sister, who was somewhat older than I, so I would get off of my horse and ride with her on her horse, and we would lead my second horse. Well, we intended to go through this procedure of doubling up on my sister's horse, and when I got off of my horse, I was so cold I couldn't get on, even with her help on her horse. So finally, what I really wanted to do was sit down in the snow and rest, and she wouldn't allow that, and it's a good thing she didn't, because this is the way people freeze to death. Eventually, I did get on behind my sister on her horse, and we returned to our farm building. I must explain that in the old ranch areas and sections of Wyoming, this was all federal lease land. A small amount of land, such as 640 acres or 160 acres, would be owned by the rancher or the farmer, and then on this location he would raise prime beef cattle and other livestock, and then in order to summer range feed the cattle and the horses, why, they would be herded or turned on leased federal land, and there was a considerable amount of federal land in the area. Most of the valleys were just taken up by homesteaders, and the balance of the land, 90%, was federal, and grazing permits were issued to the ranchers and the sheep herders to graze on the great areas of sagebrush and the high fertile lands that produced the bunch grass. And seemed like this rangeland was ever productive. All it needed was a slight rainfall in the middle of a burning summer, and the whole place would blossom again in flowers, and the bunch grass would profusely grow. and the animals would become fat as the fall progressed. Usually the dry season set in, and the water previously had to be dammed into reservoirs to retain enough water to feed and water the stock. And it was on one such occasion that I crossed one of these areas of broken ground. What they would do would be to find a deep valley, and then they would dam off the end of the valley, and during the spring runoff, with the freshets and the rain, they would retain enough water in the dam. It would be an earth-filled dam. It would retain enough water to last out the summer. Many hair-raising episodes take place on a ranch. First, you must learn to ride a horse, since most of your time will be spent herding cattle or chasing wild horses or moving from point A to point B or from your place to your neighbor's location, which may be 5 or 8 miles away. So at a very early age, everyone learns to ride a horse in Wyoming, and as of this time of the early 1930s at any rate. Now they probably drive the paved highways. The country in this location was of a rolling type country. There were many, many cedar trees growing on the low foothills. Cedar's a very durable tree, and they used this for fence posts. And one of our main projects was to ride along on our horses and take two or three wagons and a hired hand or two, and to go and cut cedar posts in the usually late fall en route to the rolling hills where the red cedars grew. There were antelope and deer and elk and many varieties of small animals, the rabbits and the various game birds were much in evidence, and this is the land of the prairie chicken. The prairie chicken was nearly as large as a turkey, and a very succulent meal the prairie chicken made for many a homesteader and many an itinerant traveler through the areas of Wyoming and Montana. It was such easy game that there have been protective regulation laws to try to keep from exterminating the great prairie chicken. They, at full maturity, would weigh 4 or 5 pounds and are quite large and are not too elusive. They could be shot at or hit with a rock or snared, or they were quite susceptible to foul play, and so naturally a species such as this had to be protected. Also, there were great numbers of antelope in Wyoming at this time, and when riding along on your favorite horse, quite often a band of antelope would leap up within a few feet of where you rode the horse and flash their white tails. And if the horse is spooky, the horse sometimes leaped to one side, and this maneuver was known as a shy. When the horse shied, if the rider wasn't firmly seated, he found himself sitting in a cactus patch or a pile of boulders on the ground. And all the local horse riders and the farm types that commuted were well aware of the capability of the horse to jump out from under the rider. He would land with a considerable force, and he'd always get skinned up and sometimes seriously break a bone. But on occasion, you could survive one of these falls, and with the exception of being shook up, why, you get on and ride off again. In this Old West, where the horse was the main means of travel, there developed a great breed of horsemen, and they followed the roundups, and they retained the wild. So, as I say, there developed a great breed of horse handlers, and they, of course, have been phased out by the mechanized age. There still is a tremendous demonstration of skill in the 4th of July type of a feature that they have, the Cheyenne Frontier Days, the Lander Frontier Days. They try to stagger their dates so that they get the best of the competing horsemen to ride the Bucking Broncos and the Brahma Steers at these gatherings. Actually, the 4th of July is a tremendous holiday in Wyoming, and it has been for years. It's celebrated by a great amount of showmanship, and the best bronc busters in the Northwest assemble and test their skills on wild range horses, and there's a considerable amount of contest in the air. It's very colorful. All of the Indian tribes turn out in their war paint and their old-fashioned headdresses made of eagle feathers and fur and the horns of buffalo and antelope, and they put on a Frontier Day show. Each seems to be a little more elaborate than the last. Very well spent time would be to see one of the Wyoming Frontier Days in action. And the duties on the farm of a young lad would be, of course, to help with all the chores. Now, these range widely from milking the cows and running the range cattle and helping to whatever the capability was in the branding of new calves, and the normal chores around a ranch are varied. In the summertime, the big press is to put the hay and the grain and the feed up for the following oncoming winter. So all of the time is spent racking up alfalfa hay into big stacks. The old method in the early 30s was to have a team of horses and the team of horses would pull up a hay stacker. Now, Wyoming was a land where you could get three complete crops of alfalfa each season, possibly four if the rain permitted. It was quite warm in the summer, and it's a great country for the diamondback rattlesnake. Many of the time, my job was to run the team that supplied the power to lift up the hay stacker. Now, this hay stacker was a leverage affair, a rack. One of the hired men would run a hay buck, which would be a machine, very primitive type of machine, to push hay up on their loader. And then the loader would catapult the hay into the air and up onto the stack, hopefully. Occasionally, I would also get the job as stacker. It is necessitated taking a pitchfork and moving the hay that had been pitched up in the air and landed in a pile. It moved this hay into a formed shape of a stack. The big scatter was when a rattlesnake or two was observed or heard in the load of hay as it was catapulted by the primitive machine into the air onto the stack, because the stack was of a limited area, maybe 30 foot square, and there'd be one or two live rattlesnakes in the hayload as it was catapulted and lifted into the air and landed hopefully on the stack. So at this point, this haystack was usually evacuated long enough to determine that the snake had made his way down out through the bottom of the haystack. I might add that the diamondback rattlesnakes are extremely dangerous, very poisonous, and their bite is often fatal. There's an approved method of surviving rattlesnake bite. It involves cutting the wound open with a sharp knife and sucking the venom from the wound before it enters the bloodstream. Now, later on, as the corn became ripened and the grain began to ripen, there were additional jobs of shocking the corn, husking the corn, and stacking it inside of a large area barn. The wheat was cut and with a binding machine and lay in shocks, large bundles, in the path. The machine had freshly cut. The job of the hired hands and any of the lads able in the area, all the farm types, was to shock the wheat into stacks so that it might properly dry. At a later time, a thrashing machine would come through, and when properly dried, the wheat would then be put into the thrasher and thrashed. Later, they invented a machine called a columbine, which did the whole operation at one fell swoop. The timing had to be right so that the wheat would be ripe enough so that it would thrash properly, and also not too ripe so that it could be retained by the thrashing machine. The time passed swiftly on the farm. We were very busy. This was a combination farm and ranch. We also, in addition to farming to support the cattle and the sheep, we raised horses in order that we should negotiate the area in style on horseback. At the age of 8, a tragedy struck, and I was taken with my mother to the small town of Lander. Myself, the sister, and the mother were then relocated in the town of Lander, Wyoming, where my mother operated a very successful rooming house for a number of years. Town of Lander, very active, small western town located in the center of farming and cattle raising activities, was a good spot for a young lad to be raised in the surroundings of the mountains and excellent fishing in the nearby streams. When I was 13 years old, I by chance got a good combination summer job throughout the summer season. This would allow me to make wages and to prepare for the road finally, which led northbound to Alaska. The job was with an old establishment called the Wyoming Tie and Timber Company, and each spring they moved thousands and thousands of railroad ties from a location high in the Du Bois, Wyoming area via a river several hundred miles to a pickling plant located at a town called Riverton. Now this area was very short of roads. The place where the ties were cut, was remote in a heavily timbered area. The ties were skidded by sled and by workhorse team to a large flume, which as I recall, was 15 or 20 miles long, and they were flumed down to the Great Wind River. As ponderous as it may seem, this was the method in which the ties were moved at that time. That is, they were cut by hand in the big woods, and they were then horse-teamed to the flume, and then they were run at the first breakup of the water, with the help of the water, down the flume to the Great Wind River. Thousands and thousands of ties were moved in this manner to the pickling plant, which was located several hundred miles down the Big Wind River. This was a Herculean task for about 50 or 70 tie drivers, and also their backup crews was the personnel it took to run their portable, movable camp and complete with all cooking facilities. My job was to in the portable kitchen, the main method of cooking was in huge 2 foot in diameter Dutch ovens. Now these Dutch ovens weighed 50 or 60 pounds apiece, and they were made of heavy cast iron, and they had a top with a lip on the top so that you might, in order to cook a roast, first build a fire, and then as the fire burned down, there'd be glowing coals, and then you stack the glowing coals on top of this Dutch oven lid with the large lip on the lid that helped hold on the large amount of glowing coals. And in this manner, the cooking was done out of doors and very succulent bread and various types of food were cooked in this manner. Later on in the season, thick blueberry cobblers and other treats were cooked in this manner. It's an art that's almost a lost art to cook in the great manner of the Dutch ovens. But the chief of the operation was an old Norwegian named Adolf Solem, and he was a true master of the cooking art in the Dutch oven. When, for instance, he would estimate the bread would be just right, perfectly baked with a fine brown crust, he would slide the lid off the Dutch oven, and sure enough, almost 100% right all the time, he would find that his bread or his roast or his blueberry cobbler or whatever he'd cooked was at the stage of perfection. The drive lasted about 5 or 6 weeks down through the mighty canyon and the Wind River. The traveling van moved via truck and set up camp ahead of the drivers, and each day with good luck they could travel 10 or 15 miles. And so this was one perpetual camp breaking job and resetting the camp and to organize the traveling camp and the kitchen every day when the moving permitted. The final arrival at the pickling plant was a great day. Everyone then was given a job on the conveyor, and they recovered the ties from the great Wind River into the pickling plant.